I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about animals and animal behavior. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Some new data shows convincingly that dogs can read our emotions from our facial expressions. Scientists have been wondering about this for a long time, and now the answer is clear. Brain imaging equipment and innovative tests have been responsible in the last 15 years for showing us that humans and non-human animals share many capacities, especially feeling and thinking. As we learn more about animals, how will this change how we treat them personally and professionally? What so-called rights will animals have in their relationships with us and us with them? Will we be entitled to use animals in experiments that make them suffer or take their lives? As we understand the complexity of their lives and their capacities, will this change the way we're in charge of them? What is the advantage of becoming more conscious, more human in our relationships with animals? Or is this over the top? I remember one animal rights activist arguing on this show years ago that harvesting honey was exploiting worker bees. Is that absurd, or does that idea get at something about our moral choices? Can't wait to talk with our guest, Kari Weil, who writes, teaches, and lectures on this subject frequently. She is professor of letters at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great pleasure to be here.
Great to have you here. So let's start with the news. We saw recently that Barnum or Ringling Brothers Circus decided to give up the fight with elephants in the circus. And yeah. I wonder how you responded to that.
Well, it should have happened a long time ago. and they haven't quite given up the fight. I think they have 3 years to do so. But yeah, I mean, what we see in
For those who don't know, can you explain what's happening? I think they're saying we're not going to...
They're saying, yes, that it will be within 3 years they will no longer have elephants in the circus performing for us. And we know that elephants have been a big show for the kids, for, you know, they've been a real popular they've been very popular with audiences. But what the audiences don't see is the bullhooks and the training methods that are often cruel and brutal, and so it I think can seem and probably is often exploitation of the elephant's capacity to read our emotions, which we were just saying before, to respond to us, to want to do us, to want to work for us, and we exploit that. I don't want to say, and I think this is something that comes up often in people who work with animals. I think there is a fine line between use and abuse. I don't think all use is abuse. Mm-hmm. I think animals depend on us. We depend on them. We can use certain animals for certain things. But when we're down to exploitive techniques of bullhooks and fear tactics, I think we've gone the wrong way.
Mm. It's fascinating to me that not only in your personal life, but in your scholarly life, in your academic life, you have gone toward this subject. What is at the root of this for you?
It started academically. It started actually, oddly, with women cross-dressing in order to ride horses in France. I know you're looking surprised, but that was something I worked on a long time ago, the fact that women who wanted to ride had to get special dispensations so that they could wear clothes that would permit them to straddle, which also was not allowed. So I was interested in all kinds of things in the relations between women and horses in France in the 19th century before women straddled. That interest slowly took me to other questions of training techniques, of how horses were used, of how they were regarded, of why, when horses were the most popular animal, they were also legalized for human consumption. So horse meat became legal in France in the middle of the 19th century, and I was dumbfounded. And I was trying to think, how and why could this happen when they're treated like pets, they're also eaten? And so it was that... some of it began with that seeming contradiction.
I'm surprised that this has come up so soon in the show, because on my list of questions, I wanted to ask you about the intersection of those two things. I saw when I was reading about what you've taught and what your interests are, the early French feminism you studied and lecture and write about. And I thought, you know, it strikes me that the overlap with these two subjects, the animal welfare and feminism, it's all about power and one's place in a moral society. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think it's all about power.
I mean, those who have it's use and abuse.
Yeah,
those who have it and what we do with it.
It's use and abuse. It's also, I mean, I think with horses, there was also, which is connected, erotics of, you know, how watching women and thinking, oh, no, they shouldn't, that it would be wrong for them to straddle a horse, that is somehow it goes against convention. It goes against, you know, it would be wrong. Women should only straddle men, if you want to, not animals. Yeah. So it was, I suppose it's power, but I think there are a lot of other issues that that are aligned with that. And I think with, I mean, certainly for me, women's studies and animal studies came together there, but they also came together in very different ways, which had to do with power, but also had to do with how do those in power claim to understand, know another being who they have, in a sense, defined for the world. In the way that literature up until fairly recently, the last couple hundred years, was dominated by men who were describing women, literature has always been about a matter of humans defining animals and explaining who they are and what they are. And it's only recently that we've begun to question, well, how can animals represent themselves? Can we know them in ways that are not distorting who they are? And that's a more difficult question, because animals can't speak back or write back. They can speak back in some ways, but they can't write in ways that we accept.
I was thinking, what was his name? Is it Griffith? A professor at Princeton years ago, I went to see, who's very big on animal thinking. And at the time, he was using a straw. And his colleagues were just aghast that this man who was so brilliant in his career had turned to this. He was using a straw to try as best he could to find a way to communicate with bees.
And so he
would listen, and then he would try and make noises through the straw. And he was convinced that this was possible.
Yeah.
You know, this is 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I'll never forget it.
Yeah. So, you know, people who work with horses, for instance, are very interested in kinetic communication. You know, I know somebody recently who's been working with dancing with horses, but in which they're never on them. They're simply using body language to try and natural horsemanship is some of the same thing. It's really on the ground, using body language, eye contact, in order to see if the horse will respond, will move with you, because some who study horses see that horses will also move in synchrony with other horses. And so there's a question, which is a kind of dancing, some might say, in the field sometimes they do that. So there was a question, well, would they do that with a human? And it seems sometimes they do.
So looking at how far we've come, this is a kind of an odd thing to say, because obviously in history, some of the things we fight for now we've already had. And then they disappeared, and now we're fighting for them again. So I say this loosely. But is it fair to say that animals now enjoy, non-human animals, enjoy more rights than they ever have before?
Only some animals, only some of the non-human animals, the ones that we see. So the ones the majority of the population don't see suffer much more so in factory farms and in cages. And so I think there's a politics of visibility at work. And this actually started in the 19th century too, where it was proclaimed that slaughterhouses had to be moved outside of the city so that we wouldn't see what's happening. And there are other scholars who've been working on sort of the politics of visibility in relation to animal studies, and I mean in relation to non-human animals, and what is it that we see, what is it we don't see. Certainly our pets and certain animals have far more lavish treatment and rights and clothes and all kinds of things that they never had before. But then I think there are others who are suffering much more than before.
In a chapter, by the way, my guest, Kari Weil, who's a professor of letters at Wesleyan University and is also author of the book Thinking Animals, a chapter, we've linked to a chapter from this book, which is absolutely so fascinating, this chapter. So please go to WNPR.org, The Faith Middleton Show, to have a look at that. You wrote in that chapter that in the 20th century we had Pavlov, whose theories ruled for a long time, that all animal responses were to stimuli, to conditioning, mechanics. And now we're in a period where, through various techniques we mentioned earlier, we can see that animals feel and – or we can understand that they feel and think.
Right.
Use tools to solve problems.
Right.
So where are we going with that? What does that leap mean?
Ooh. Where we're going, I'm not sure. I think one – what it has meant is that I mean, I think this is partly behind why animal studies is growing as a field, is that we no longer can say or draw the line between what makes a human and what makes a non-human. It used to be that only humans were regarded as thinking beings, and all others, that was what distinguished us. It was thinking, consciousness, agency, certain terms that were exclusive to the human and which allowed us to claim our exceptionalism, which we were the only animals that did this, this, and the other. And now we know that we're not. And so part of what that, part of the dilemma is we don't know what it is that humans do that others, other animals don't do. So we've lost knowledge of what it is that makes us special.
So as we know more about what non-human animals do, how, I guess the big question, we can do this on the other side of this break, how does that change our relationships with them? We see that changing to some degree, but going down the road, what's going to happen there? This is Kari Weil, and she will be right back with me after we take this short break. Animal Thinking, stay with us. Faith Middleton, Wesleyan Professor Kari Weil, who lectures and writes frequently on animal welfare and society, is with us. Do you think we need new policies on the rights of or welfare of animals? Rights, such a loaded word politically, right, Kari? Been used politically so many times. By the way, Dr. Weil is author of Thinking Animals. I almost called you Dr. Weil. I was going to give you the Kurt Weil
That's
treatment.
Okay. Like,
I promised that we would discuss. We can see things changing in terms of our relationships.
Oh, yeah. Certainly, the circus elephants is one thing. I think also the question. I mean the question of whether chimps, I mean, that it now seems that we are going to stop the United States has been the last bastion of testing on apes. And I think, if I'm correct, that's slowly being phased out, we hope. But it's certainly the lack of a clear distinction between humans and animals raises the question of what gives us the right to do to other animals what we wouldn't do to our own species. And those are ethical questions.
This is an increasingly challenging argument to make in the time of ISIS, wouldn't you say? It seems that in terms of, say, the Holocaust and slavery and what ISIS is doing overseas, beheading people, raping children, it's a hard argument to make about the civility of humans the moment.
Yes. So that's, I think, we certainly can't say that humans are an ethical species. But if we want to be an ethical, or I'm not even sure if we want. I don't know what we are as a species. I suppose that's what things keep coming to. I don't know how to characterize humans. And I think often, even when we want to be ethical, we falter. Often, we can be best intentioned and do wrong things, do stupid things. Yeah, it's.
Do you think the digital world has had something very powerful to do with our changing feelings about animals, how we think about them, how we empathize with them?
Well, that's interesting because I've heard that in the news, if you have a dog in a story, your readership goes up. I don't know how many percent, but dogs sell stories now.
And books. What's that joke about Lincoln's dogs? Just have to string together five words and you're all set.
So again, maybe this goes back to the question of visibility. I mean, we see so much about certain animals, and that maybe has been a good thing. But there are still gag laws about certain animals that we're not allowed to see. So there's always I don't know if we can say that the internet has been helpful. Certainly it's helpful. It's helpful in a political sense just because I get, every day I get things from the Humane Society, from the Dodo. I don't know if you know the Dodo, which is an online press that shows, cute dogs and all kinds of animals that need help or this or that. It's an interesting.
Here's what I'm thinking about in terms of the digital age and communication that way is the things that you mentioned, yes, the stories of unlikely animal relationships which then spawned the PBS series about that. And so that sort of opens the door to, there's more flexibility and more here. There's more room here than we thought. The stories about cruelty, the videos about food processing plants, stories about animal rights activists who many would say have gone too far in some cases, all of it out there.
Yeah.
In a way that radio, television, and print couldn't do before.
Well, that's true. So there is, yes, and we're much more attuned to what's happening in the non-human world, I suppose, and that I think much of that is to their benefit, to the non-human benefit, non-human animals, to the benefit of non-human animals, I suppose. I'm not sure if the overload of information sometimes. It can be an overload, which makes people turn off too. And I mean, I know there's only so many faces of dogs, starving dogs that I can see before I just click and say delete, and I can't take anymore. So there is a risk of being overloaded with images, especially.
There's also, we were laughing just as the show started, because there is a tendency among us all in describing a dog or a cat to open the paragraph by saying it's not a rescue, with a great sense of apology.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so we have these, you know, fantastic rescue organizations out there doing this great work. And but there is a kind of political correctness that comes with these things.
Yeah.
Where you think, oh dear, you know, I should have adopted a child instead of having one. You know, I mean, there are so many kids who need a home. It's that kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
The morality. Here are your moral questions.
These are moral questions. And, you know, I think there are arguments on both sides. Well, I'm not sure. I think reasons that people go for, well, perhaps acceptable reasons in my book for why people would go for a purebred is to get a dog that is most compatible with your lifestyle, and so that you can really give that dog a good home, be able to, you know, if you're a runner, take the dog running. If you're sedentary and can't go out, have a small dog that doesn't want to go out, something like that. I mean, that there's shapes and temperaments and so on that are compatible. Because it's true, with a rescue dog, often it's a lot more work. Often, not always, but sometimes can be. You know, but you never know what you're getting either way. I mean, that's the luck of reproduction,
of all
in human
reproduction.
All reproduction, not just It's a difficult question.
So it was so interesting to me when you said, as we were meeting and getting ready for this show, that you had asked someone, I don't know, was it an animal behaviorist at a conference, about whether animals understand difference among themselves.
Yeah. So I was at a conference few months ago, where Frans de Waal, who is probably one of the foremost primatologists in the country, was speaking. And de Waal has been very influential, because he has basically shown how apes experience empathy, and has promoted ideas about empathy being an evolutionary trait that we have inherited from the primates, from the apes. But he has said that empathy for them is much easier within their in-group, which means, I guess, you know, what that means is usually the family or something to that extent. So I wanted to know how I asked him, so how do they learn difference, meaning how do they learn, or when do they learn, and is it a learning process of who is in the in-group and who is not? So What makes the difference of who are the other animals with whom they can feel empathy, and who are the ones that they first see as enemy? And he didn't really have a good answer. I didn't get a clear answer.
Do you think that everybody's trying to figure that out right now?
I think it's a question that has not been answered, and that there's probably, yes, there's an assumption that an in-group is somebody you're born with, or it's and I think it's, again, a nature-nurture. It's not clear whether you just are born knowing your family, or whether, for instance, if your family contains a dog and a rat and a few humans, are they your family? My dog was very good friends with our guinea pig. We could let them both out in the yard, and they would just play together. The dog actually dropped the ball for the guinea pig to throw once. You know, and I think she knew this as family, as in-group. She knew the guinea pig, is my reading of it. And she also doesn't chase squirrels. And I thought maybe she thought squirrels, maybe I'm projecting. But that raises the question for me of, is it a natural sense of who is family and who isn't? Or is it something that we're taught that we're
and we are told that there are certain species of animals seem to, or at least that's how they describe them,
yeah.
seem to specialize in taking care of each
Absolutely.
Other. These are non-monogamous. These are monogamous.
Yep.
These two are devoted for life, and these ones aren't, and will go anywhere they feel like going.
And it's funny how we're so surprised by the way in which other species will have interspecies friendships. So horses and goats, or there's all kinds of things on the internet about this, and in wild animals and so on. And I wonder, is it only because we think we're the only species that extends a hand to other species?
Well, you know, though, sometimes the ones that create a friendship are so surprising because they're normally predator and prey.
Sometimes, yeah.
You know, a lion and a deer.
Right.
Lying down together is just astounding. And licking each other and hanging out is just really astounding.
Right.
You know, you think, let there be peace in the world.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it just
brings
out something so incredible in people. All right, let me open the phones because this starts a whole conversation. I'm with Akari Weil, who is professor of letters at Wesleyan University, lectures, writes, and teaches about animal welfare, the language of it, its relationship to feminism, in fact. Our number here is 203-776-9677, 203-776-WNPR. Where are we headed with animal welfare? How far do we have to go? I wonder, in terms of power, on the face of it, we have it, and the non-human animals do not, unless you're in certain situations where... You know, I'm walking down a path in Colorado and there's a mountain lion. I know who has the power in that situation. So, but most of the time we have the power, and yet we don't think about that in terms of how we eat these animals, what is done with their lives to provide us this food source.
Right.
And on it goes, how we keep these animals at home, how we use them in work, how we use them in entertainment.
Right. It's even, I think, in some ways a much broader question because the instances that you mentioned with the mountain lion, we have reduced those really pretty much into our control. You can choose whether to go to that mountain. And so it's rare that we are in a situation where we are dominated by animals. I think bacteria are more likely to be the predators on us than lions or, you know, the dinosaurs are extinct, of course, but other species. And I think that's what's behind this notion of the Anthropocene or Anthropocene, depending on how one pronounces it, that we are now in a geologic age in which there is nothing that has not been there. There are no places that have not been touched by human action, human activity, and so in a sense, we have dominated the earth to such an extent that whether it's pollution, whether it's habitat, whether it's food, all the resources have greatly we have greatly managed them for us. And have often thought, not thought about other species that also need resources, that also need clean air, that also need certain climates that we have affected. So there's been so much that we haven't, that we've disregarded with regard to other species on the planet in the way we run our lives.
Well, how do you think about sharing the world with non-human animals? How do you personally think about it? I don't mean to offend you or anybody else, but I eat them. I'm a carnivore, and so I try my best to look at sources and how things are handled. But
sure.
I know I'm absolutely can promise you that I'm sometimes buying things from a system that is just horrifying.
Well, it's not easy to be vegetarian or vegan in, you know, when the majority of life is not. And, you know, I'm not going to condemn eating animals. But I think for me, facing or understanding what an animal goes through, and the lives that we have forced animals to live in order to be our food, I think, you know, that has changed my point of view. And because we, you know, it's become such an industry, and it's become unhealthful for us as well, for those who eat meat, and given the antibiotics and everything else that happens there.
You know, just do you sense this? Just as surgeons can sometimes psychologically and purposefully distance themselves from patients so that they can actually pick up a scalpel and cut into the flesh of us. We see other people who are able to do this with animals.
Oh, yeah.
Hunters have to be able to do this. I'm thinking of the story of a man I know who's a hunter, and he is a very responsible, good hunter, very careful about how he does everything. And he once said to me that he was in the West and he was shooting prairie dogs. And I said, what? And he said, yes. And I said, oh, my God, that's awful. Mm. And he said, oh, they are a big problem out there. They have these holes, and then the cattle break their legs, and it's a terrible thing for the ranchers. And it went down this line, this chain. And yet, I what I could not get out of my head was a certain enjoyment of blasting away these creatures. So that is about a kind of psychological distance, a capacity for that we have in ourselves to make sense of things.
It's interesting you bring that up because it's something I'm trying to write about right now, about what allows some to avoid the eye or to avoid certain knowledges, certain ways of knowing what else goes on, and the ways some of us have to. I mean, some of us, to in order to live, there are certain things. Just as I said before, I have to turn off. I can't look at another starving dog. I mean, that for some of us, there's a limit for how much suffering in the world we can accept in order to go on. But I'm interested in what. At what point that is, and what allows some people to simply avoid, I mean, some of this is in a 19th century poet I've been reading, but what allows some people not to look at those eyes or to see something completely different in those eyes? It's a kind of reading, you know, what allows some people to really read that there is suffering there, and what allows other people to avoid it.
I am going to mangle this, but was it Shakespeare who said something like, one must not lie to oneself before lying to others?
Yeah.
You know exactly where you're coming from.
Yeah.
And so that distance you're describing is where the tricky part comes in.
Yeah.
We're going to, Kari Weil is here and from Wesleyan University. We're talking about animal thinking and behavior, our relationship with non-human animals. And we'd love for you to join in, 203-776-WNPR. We'll take a quick break and come right back. I'm Faith Middleton. Thanks so much for listening. And thanks also to our producers, Jonathan McNichol and Lori Mack. My guest is Kari Weil, Wesleyan University. And we have a link to a chapter from her book, Thinking Animals?
Thinking Animals. Why Animal Studies Now.
Yeah. Why Animal Studies Now?
Oh, why animal studies now? Well, it is a growing field in academia, and I think so. I try to explain this in a chapter, why I think it's important. Some of it has to do with things we've been talking about, precisely the fact that we no longer know what makes the line of difference between humans and animals, and that raises all kinds of questions about our relations to them, how we understand ourselves, who we want to be in our relations with animals. I should say non-human animals, because we are animals as well.
It's just so bulky.
It is bulky. So, yeah, I usually say that and then go on and say animals. And I think animal studies has also grown similarly but differently from area studies like women's studies, ethnic studies, and so on, because it has to do with questions of the field is how do we deal with difference? How do we deal with otherness? Terms that we've been using a lot in academia to talk about people, first of all, who we think are different from ourselves, and we try and understand what that difference consists in and what language we can define.
The chapter from your book is A Proper Death, as in Dying Like a Dog.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an absolutely fascinating chapter, and I beautifully stated, and you really got me thinking about how exploring the rituals of death in the animal world enable us to get close to something human in ourselves, or maybe help us to identify with animals more when we see that they too have rituals and they too have grief.
Right.
That rats laugh, you said.
Yeah. I think it's Barbara King who's written on animal grief, and this has become a big topic also. The fact that elephants have certain mourning rituals, the fact that, yes, I think we see it, those of us who have been around dogs and horses, who know that if one of their, if you have more than one dog and one dies, the other dog will show, will feel that absence. And so that the fact that animals also grieve, that they have memories, that they miss, they know our absence, and that certainly makes it difficult when you think that you might, that you, your animal, the animal that lives with you, might outlive you. I know we were talking about that before.
What about the way our language has changed to reflect our different way of thinking about this, maybe a change in our ethics or morals about this? You used to be able to say you were a pet owner, and now people tend not to say that. Let me see. So you're an animal, you have an animal companion, or you're a guardian.
Right.
Are two that come to mind.
Right. Guardian is I think I wrote about this because when I was first writing the book or writing that chapter, I was living in Berkeley. And of course, there you could only be a pet guardian, not a pet owner. We don't say we're owners of our children, but as we take care of them. So the idea is whether or not you can own another creature, and people are resistant to that idea of ownership.
And even before that, whether a human being is the same as a non-human animal, are they the same? If you can't own a child, is it somehow different if it's an animal?
Well, there are legal differences. I mean, so the flip side of this is only animals that you own are animals that you have that you can protect. So you can't individually, for instance, take in a wild animal and be able to protect that animal in certain ways. The law will support you with your pet as something of yours, of your property, but it becomes your property. But as property, it has protection. A wild animal can't be property, which seems freeing. But at the same time, if a you know, a bird falls on your porch or crashes into your house or something, and you want to help it, you don't really have the legal right to do so. So there are ways in which being an animal owner gives you a certain, you know, gives you certain rights with regard to that animal that you wouldn't otherwise have. But nobody wants to think
this
of...
This is just like Star Trek. Honestly,
yeah. It's a catch 22.
There he was, you know, going through space, exploring these societies, and you could see these were the morals in this place. This is a behavior in another place. And how were the humans coming from Earth going to negotiate all this without telling them you can't do this, you can do that, sometimes taking a stand, sometimes not? It feels like that's where we are with
Well, it's also because the ethics and legality are often at odds with each other. The legal system, I mean, that goes back to the question of rights. It's not clear that what animals need are rights, because that would assume that they also can sign contracts, or that they have to. We wouldn't think of giving rights to somebody who can't understand the language of the contract.
Also, not politically smart to call it that.
Yeah,
people are offended of the word rights.
Of the word rights. So my colleague Lori Grun has written about this also, and she, you know, says it's more about our duties. Rights also don't come without you don't get rights for nothing. Rights you can have your rights taken away. We as humans, right? If we do something that goes against the law, we can have our rights taken away and being put in jail. The question of rights also brings up questions of what would an animal, non-human animal, understand about the situation in which they have those rights, and can have them? Could they have them then taken away if they, you know?
I read a fascinating book on the lives of crows. A research scientist did this book, and it was astounding how smart they are. I've never looked at them on the road the same way since. I mean, their description of their societies, their rituals, the way they use tools to solve problems. We've seen some of this on these nature specials on PBS.
Pipes and things that they'll use to dig.
But the death ritual for crows was fascinating to me, because when one of them dies, they all gather and they form a circle. And I mean, a perfect circle, all facing in toward the center of the circle, and no one knows what exactly they're doing when they do the circle, but they only do it when one of them dies.
Oh.
So it's some kind of ritual for them.
Yeah, that's interesting. So there again, we would think that rituals are a sign of a culture. And it used to be that only humans had culture. There were no cultures. Culture was the distinction between nature and, you know, it was nature, culture. Nature, animals were nature. Now we know that animals also have their own cultures. Different species have different cultures and different rituals.
You said, and what about this part in this chapter we've linked to at Faith Middleton Show, WNPR.org, Thinking Animals, your book, about ants. Was it a scientist who told the story of what happens when you destroy an ant's home?
I'm trying to think of
I'll look up who it is.
Okay. So there is
Rebuild.
They do rebuild, and that was that was an experiment about it seemed to be a rather not very nice experiment. They were trying to see if ants both whether they would rebuild their homes and how they would find the way back to that home. I think this was in a different, not in my book, but in something else I wrote about. But in order to prove that, we had to destroy the homes and keep moving them. And there were ants that found the way back home. Did you find?
So they have a sense of home.
They have a sense of home, and they also have a sense of direction and how to, because it would be, I can't remember which ant it was that would then take the other ants and lead them to the new home.
This explains why I say, like a crazy woman all by myself, when they're in the house, this is my home. You need to leave here right
well,
now.
Well, so then you have to teach them how to go to their home. And
you need to go. So there is someone here who you say in your chapter, a woman who had begun a cremation service for horses. There are very few in the country.
Yeah.
This is at the time, I think. Did you lose your horse?
I did. I lost my horses. I had found a wonderful retirement home for my horse when I moved east because she was already older. And this was a place where she could roam and play and drink water and to her heart's content. And shortly after I left, the vet, I got a call from the owner of the place saying that she had stopped eating. And they wanted to take her to the vet, so they did. And the vet said it seemed like probably a lymphoma, they thought, and they could do something or not. Anyway, long story, we decided that the best thing was to euthanize her, which was hard enough in itself. But then I was told that I had to make immediate decision as to what would happen with her body, because horses are not legally pets. Horses are in this in-between status where they are also livestock.
In the law.
And as livestock, when they die on the property, somebody will take them, usually the renderer or some service will come and take them if you can't take them yourself.
So that your horse was about to become food for another animal, other animals.
Well, you know, food for another animal, I might have been able to accept. I'm not sure. I wasn't sure what would happen to her. And I, you know, if maybe food for another animal, I thought that might be a good way to think of it. But at the time, I didn't know what to think of it. And I wanted to have some testimony to my love for her.
Yeah. Kari, this comes, that's why the death rituals around animals are so important. This comes down to the relationship for me between the word respect mm-hmm. and animals other than ourselves. Mm-hmm. How do we define that? You know, the fact that you went to such care with your horse all the way to the end and burial says a lot about your moral choices. You know, it's why people buy gravestones, mm-hmm. have mm-hmm. ceremonies. It's so, so interesting and important. Mm-hmm.
I think they, you know, anybody who has lived with an animal closely will, I think, believe that they are part of our lives and we grieve them. And so then the question becomes, how do we have a testament to their importance? Do we just get rid of them or say goodbye? And I don't think that.
As we do, as humans.
As we do as humans. You know, and I'm not sure what the best way to do that is. I think, you know, for each of us, it's probably different because, as I think I said in that chapter too, I asked myself, who am I doing this for? Am I doing it for the horse or am I doing it for me? Because for a horse, it can also take a day to cremate them.
So a day.
Unlike a dog, which can happen in a few minutes. I mean, they're big. It's an energy consumption. It's a lot of time. It's a lot of work. And maybe it would have been better to let her be eaten by other animals if I could have sort of, as in Tolstoy's short story, it happens that the horse is sort of left out for other animals to live off of so that her death would have been life for another.
Thank you so much for being on the show. This is Kari Weil, professor of letters at Wesleyan University, author of the book Animal Thinking, a chapter on our website. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, great recipes, everything right now at the Faith Middleton Show, WNPR.org. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.
joy.